WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Mason Chambliss with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, July 8th. Barely a week after voting to create it, Sarasota County announced the first head of its new stormwater department yesterday. The county did not conduct a national search for program director, instead selecting Sarasota native Ben Quartermain. Quartermain graduated from University of Central Florida and has been working for almost 30 years in civil design and stormwater infrastructure. He was previously involved with the Florida House Sustainability Project and has more recently worked for Stantec, an engineering firm contracted by the biggest developers in the area. Passed over for the position was Steven Sow, who wrote an independent post-flood analysis that highlighted weaknesses in the county's stormwater management system. The 2025 School Accountability Report is out, and Ron DeSantis is praising testing improvements across the state. Yesterday, while in Jacksonville, the governor announced that 71% of graded schools earned a performance grade of A or B, a 7% increase from the previous year. Practically, he added, this means almost 200,000 more students in the state are now attending A or B graded schools. There was no change in local outcomes. The Sarasota County School District maintained its A rating, with no schools in the district earning less than a C, while Manatee kept its B, with two schools getting D rankings. Sarasota ranks among the 8 highest scoring counties in Florida, with Nassau and St. John's counties achieving the highest scores. The Big Water Land Trust selected a Sarasota teenager's photo as winner for their 2025 Summer Photo Contest. The photo was taken and submitted by Bryce Claypool, a conservation activist who runs a website titled The Kid Who Cares. The monochrome picture depicts an underwater scene of a large fish amidst a school of smaller fishes. It was chosen, said juror Karen Arango, because it, quote, stood out instantly, not just for its technical excellence, but for the powerful narrative it captures in a single frame. The stark contrast between predator and prey, chaos and calm, is breathtaking, unquote. Around 200 people showed up Saturday morning for a rally by the League of Women Voters of Sarasota County. The event along Bayside Drive in downtown was tied to the Unite and Rise 8.5 campaign. The organizers called for the protest to, quote, empower voters and defend democracy, unquote. The nonpartisan League of Women Voters emphasized that this rally was not in protest against any individual or party, instead standing up for the Constitution against authoritarian policies and actions. This has been Mason Chambliss with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, July 8th.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and VPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 65 of our changing environment. The previous show was Corduroy, hosted by Sebastian.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm John O'Miller, and this show is being recorded and broadcast on July 8th, 2025.
Today we're going to be doing something different, chatting for a half hour with the City of Sarasota's Sustainability and Resilience Manager, Aaliyah Garrett, and then switching to reminiscing about America's first environmental martyr, Guy Bradley.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Aaliyah, it's great to have you back in a new role. The previous time we spoke with you, you were working for IFAS, and you were promoting the Eco Summit, right?
Yes.
And then, and now your new role is working for the City of Sarasota in the sustainability and resilience sector.
It is, and it's so nice to be back.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your new responsibilities.
Yeah, so I work for the Sustainability and Resilience Program, and a lot of what we do focuses on internal operations and also community-wide initiatives as well. So some of the things we focus on include community education and outreach, resilience planning, waste reduction, energy, Sustainability and resilience touch a lot of different brackets, so it's very broad what I work on, but just trying to implement projects that improve our community and make us bounce back stronger from these, you know, stronger and more frequent storms we're seeing.
So what is resilience planning?
So resilience planning means making sure our city can handle and bounce back from climate challenges like the stronger and more frequent storms we're seeing, as I mentioned. So anything we can do to harden our infrastructure, have more green and resilient architecture, things like that.
And so is bouncing back from heat, would that be one as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You can be resilient against so many different types of environmental challenges
we're
facing.
All right. Well, so tell us, in addition to the storms and the flooding and the heat, what else is under consideration that you work with?
So those are the main things I'm working on now. Okay. I'm very new to my role, but I would say that storms, flooding, and heat are probably our top three at the moment.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you understand that the county is no longer going to provide stormwater assistance to the city?
There's been conversations about that. I don't think that there's any final determination on that. Okay. So, yeah, we'll hear more from the county and city leadership when, you know, the time comes.
That's interesting and good, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. how is rising sea level affecting infrastructure in the city?
So we did recently complete a vulnerability assessment and adaptation plan, and there's a public story map that's available on our website. It's called Preparing for Our Future. So if anybody wants to learn more about the study and what we found, definitely check that out. But to your point, sea level rise, it is, you know, going to impact us. The study that we did focused on the years 2040 and 2070. It was part of a statewide program called Resilient Florida, so most cities and counties in the state did apply for that and get funding to complete projects. And we looked at city assets, critical community and regional assets, and how they're impacted by flooding. So we are going to see some changes from sea level rise increasing and how that impacts our infrastructure. We did find that critical infrastructure was more impacted than natural areas, which I'm not surprised by. Just working on projects and trying to apply for grants and other programs that can help us to make our infrastructure more resilient and less impacted by flooding.
So this is radio, and we can't really see, but tell us, what is a story map?
So it's like, I don't even know how to describe it. Yeah, it's like, it's online, and basically it's, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like a website, and you can scroll down, and it's very visual. It has lots of maps and pictures, and it really walks you through the study in a way that's, like, very visual.
Okay, and how would people get there?
It's on our City of Sarasota Sustainability and Resilience webpage, and it's called Preparing for Our Future. There's a link to it. You'll see it on there.
So talk more about the balance and your role between the city's infrastructure and the city's resources versus individual residents and their situations.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot that residents can do. It's very broad in what you can do to impact, like, not only resilience but sustainability. One of the greatest resources we have here locally is the Green Living Toolkit. The Science and Environment Council and a bunch of other local partners worked to create this. I think IFAS was involved as well. And it's at greenlivingtoolkit.org. It has different categories. It's energy, waste, food, water, and nature, if I'm not mistaken. And individuals can learn more about each of those topics. But I think what I love the most about the toolkit is that it's very action oriented. So for each category, there's specific things that individuals can do to make their homes more energy efficient. And then when you're being more energy efficient, like say you get impact windows, for example, that's better for being resilient against storms. So a lot of these things have co-benefits as well.
Okay, so we've started down resilience. Now talk about sustainability. What what's going on with sustainability in this city?
So sustainability, the definition is meeting the needs of the present without sacrificing the future's ability to meet their own needs. So what we're trying to do is, you know, reduce our waste, our consumption, be more wise. So sustainability really is helping to care for the planet and everyone living on it, while resilience prepares us to face and adapt to change. So as far as sustainability, some of our programs include education, which is really just educating the public and community members, students, about ways that they can be more energy efficient, reduce their waste, take care of our planet. So we do a lot of community cleanups. We have Earth Day festivals. There's so many ways that we try to educate individuals about the things that they can do.
So, again, in addition to the dealing with the citizens of the city, is there also an emphasis on reducing waste within the city?
Yes, absolutely. So we're always looking at, you know, community-wide initiatives, but also internal operations. So one of the things that I worked on or am currently working on at the city is just, you know, making sure that our recycling is as great as it can be. It was already great when I started, but just doing an audit, making sure that everybody has a recycle bin, that everyone is educated on what they can and can't recycle. So I actually have a meeting coming up with somebody internally to talk about ways that we can educate employees, whether that's an email blast or signage, anything to get the word out there. So everybody knows, you know, this is what we can and can't recycle. And there actually is a city ordinance that requires all businesses and residents to recycle. It's in Chapter 16. Yes, Chapter 16. So
I know there was interest a while ago in working with the restaurants in the city to work on composting. Do you know, is anything happening in that regard?
Yeah, I did hear about that. That's one of the things. I don't think my predecessor, but actually it was maybe my predecessor. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was Stevie, his predecessor. Uh-huh. But yes, there was a pilot program at one point in time. That's something I'm definitely interested in exploring. There are a few like amazing community groups like Sunshine Community Compost, who I love. Shout out to them.
Uh-huh.
And there's More Bliss Farms that does great composting Monday events. Mm-hmm. So definitely check those out. So I'm very supportive of community composting and interested to see what the city can do to support those initiatives.
Something we've mentioned on the show previously, and this may get in the category of bouncing back or resilience as well as recycling, was the potential when we have a fish kill, when we have a red tide and a lot of fish, instead of just landfilling those, could they be composted going back to whatever Squanto teaching the pilgrims to plant a dead fish with the corn. Fish fertilizer is, you can go to a big box store and buy fish fertilizer. So it's important to get those fish off the beaches. But instead of viewing them just as a problem, maybe there's some way they could be recycled and become a benefit, and we could be selling Sarasota fish fertilizer.
Yeah, definitely something we would want to lean on our community partners for. I know we're not in the business. The city is not in the business of selling fish fertilizer, for sure, anything for that matter, but definitely something. I love creative solutions, so anything that we can do that provides co-benefits, I'm a full supporter of.
Yeah, that's an interesting topic.
Yeah. I know we got to have Tracy or somebody on here to talk about composting some more.
Well, so what are I'm just curious about the techniques for bouncing back from storm, from weather events. What are some of the strategies that improve resilience and ability to recover?
Yeah, I definitely think like multiple forms of energy are really important. So anything you can do to have solar and battery backup is super important. Other things include things to help mitigate with flooding. So pervious pavement is a great option when it floods. Hopefully it can percolate down pretty quickly. Anything we can do to help our wetlands and just really anything we can do, we're focused on flooding mainly.
Yeah. Something we learned is that that sort of, you talked about the diversity of the support. So people mm-hmm. will get a generator in order to back up a system. And then they'll be worried that what if that generator fails, and then they'll get a second generator. Well, if you get the same type of generator that runs on the same fuel, then the problem that took out your first generator is likely to
take out the second one. And that's the word I was looking for, is redundancy.
Yeah,
it's
right.
All about like having different types of energy sources, not necessarily 10 of the same source,
right.
But you
right.
know,
yeah.
different types.
I'm a big advocate of redundancy, and yeah. it's a hard sell sometimes. We see that in our comprehensive planning. Mm-hmm. People say, well, this is in section 6, so we don't need to say it again in section 8. And I'm saying, look, no one's ever going to print this document. It exists on it's just a few bits or bytes on the computer. Enabling people to find the same information at two locations is an asset, not a liability. Mm-hmm. So that redundancy is helpful.
Mm-hmm. Back to flooding. It seems like in Helene, there was a lot of flooding of the barrier islands and some flooding along the city of Sarasota shoreline. And so what can people do to be more resilient from flooding?
So the county actually has a great program right now where you can get rebates for different stormwater improvements you make to your home, like rain barrels, pervious pavement, so bioswales, anything that you can do like that, I would highly recommend. And I do just, my heart goes out to anybody who's been impacted by flooding. It really does. And, you know, I hope everybody's prepared for this hurricane season. You got all your supplies and everything. But mainly I would just focus on if you can elevate, that's a great option. I know that's expensive, not feasible for everybody. If you can't do that, I would try to get pervious pavement, and do some of the things that the stormwater rebate program has. And I'm really proud of the county for doing something like that. So there are resources available for folks.
I saw sort of a Zillow map recently of all the, places for sale on Sanibel in the wake of the storms. Mm-hmm. And we've met people that have moved from the Keys to downtown Sarasota. You know, downtown Sarasota has great elevation. We used to live on 3rd Street, which is now Fruitville. And behind our house, there was an alley. And on the other side of the alley was sandpine. So it was the last sandpine in downtown Sarasota. Oh. But what that indicated was that that was a scrub community. Mm-hmm. So if you're living in downtown Sarasota, flooding you probably need to worry about would be a tsunami because there's really a lot of elevation in the downtown area.
Yeah, and that's what we found in our vulnerability assessment and adaptation plan is really those low-lying areas are the ones that are the most impacted.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to freak people out. Yes. We do totally. Not have a tsunami warning system in the Gulf of Mexico. And we could. And people say, well, why would you need a tsunami tsunami warning system? Well, one of the ways tsunamis occur is when a part of the continental shelf detaches and just slumps down into the deeper water. And so even though having a meteorite strike the Gulf of Mexico is probably a pretty low probability event, and there are no volcanoes or whatever, we could lose a section of the continental shelf, and that would cause a tsunami, and there is no warning system, at least the last time I checked, for the Gulf.
Aaliyah, anything else that you would like to share about your new position in the city of Sarasota?
What I really want to make sure I have time to talk about is the annual Sustainable Communities Workshop, if we can touch on that.
Yeah.
Does that sound good?
It's a classic.
It's a classic. It's my favorite event of the year.
And that's in the fall, right?
It's in the fall. It's coming up. Mark your calendars.
Okay,
November 6th.
Okay.
It's an annual event that's been going on. This year is going to be the 20th annual. I can't even believe that it's been going on for that long. When I was at IFAS at the county, I used to lead that program. Now I'm on the planning committee. But this year's theme is Then, Now, Next, 20 years of sustainable communities. So for those of you who have been here a long time or those of you who are new here, it's just a great opportunity to learn about where we've been, where we're going, where we're at. I think it's just an amazing community event that brings together such a diverse audience of residents, businesses, nonprofits, students, really anybody who's interested.
And has the location been determined?
It has. It's at the Harvest House Learning Enrichment Campus. It's off of 17th Street. It's kind of a newer venue. We're really excited to be there. They're super supportive of sustainability in general, even when we went to go tour the venue last year, or maybe it was the year before. I can't remember what it was, but whenever we toured it, we walked in and it was really hot in there, and they go, oh, we're sorry, we keep our air conditioning off in the venue to save energy when we're, you know, not using it. And I said, I love that. You don't even got to be sorry. That's great. So, you know, so very excited about that. It's an all-day event. And there actually is an award ceremony and social following the workshop at the same venue from 4 to 6. So it'll be a whole day of fun, learning, education, celebration, all the good things.
And there's usually like a local sort of sustainable meal that's provided?
Yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at our options this year. Always try to keep it local and as sustainable as possible.
And then you have the sustainable flatware and plates and cups.
We're looking at all sorts of options, and that's something that I'm talking to the new outreach coordinator over there about. She's great because a lot of the options that we're seeing are only industrially compostable, but we're trying to find options that are home compostable because, you know, we don't have any local industrial facilities for those, and just trying to make sure we're as sustainable as possible in our actions.
So say again what the title of the sustainability community meeting is.
So it's the annual Sustainable Communities Workshop, and the theme this year is Then, Now, Next, 20 Years of Sustainable Communities. And some of the topics that we're going to talk about include resilient architecture, so really excited to hear more about that, sustainable business, climate communication, and more. So it'll cover a really broad range of topics. We're going to have some really exciting speakers. I don't want to give too much away, but definitely wanted to give a sneak peek. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be in person and online. So you can join us off 17th Street, absolutely. Okay. But for those of you who are tuning in that aren't local, there is an option to join virtually as well.
Well, when I was working at the New College, we would usually bring a a van load of students. We had to convince students. They would say, well, I have a class that day. And I said, well, sometimes your classes get in the way of your education. you might want to talk to your professor and say, look, I have this unique opportunity to learn about sustainability from people all over the country. They bring not only local experts, but experts from out of state to talk. And so, maybe I could miss your class and catch up with a classmate and have this whole day to learn about sustainability.
I'm with you. Thank you for encouraging those students. Yeah. Absolutely. And we always want students there. So if you have any connections, if you are a student and you're listening, or a professor, a teacher, we would love to have
them
there.
And as I recall, I don't know if they're still doing it, but they used to have, a situation where students could undertake some of the tasks, like giving people name tags and stuff, and that would help with their...
We do have volunteer roles, not just for students, but for anybody, but we do have discounted student tickets anybody...
We can't talk about it on the show, but
yes.
Okay. Well, that'd be something to look forward to. 20 years, I think, I don't know if we went to the first one or not, but we've been involved over the years.
And so the Harvest House facility is at the corner of 17th and Beneva. Is that right?
Yes, I believe that's Beneva.
Okay,
yes.
Great.
Have you been over there before?
I'm trying to visualize it.
Yeah. It's the southeast corner of 17th and Beneva.
It's like a big blue building. It's a beautiful yard, some oak trees out front.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Lots of parking.
Lots of parking. We love that.
Plenty of free parking.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Yes, there's that. And there's a bus route that goes right there. So for anybody who's interested in taking, you know, public transportation.
Now, that's our local sustainability event. But you go to a national or a regional sustainability. What did you learn there?
Oh, I learned so much. So, yes, an organization that both the city and the county are part of, it's the Southeast Sustainability Directors Network.
Uh-huh.
And it's all of the city and county local government people, not all, but a lot of the city and county government people in the southeastern United States. So they have an annual conference as well. A lot of what we covered is talking about resilience, flooding, climate communications, how AI is impacting us, lots of different important and upcoming topics. And it's just great to learn from people in our region who have faced the similar challenges that we do.
Now, do most of our neighboring counties and cities have positions comparable to yours?
Yes. In Florida, we actually have our own subgroup of that called the Florida Sustainability Directors Network, or FSDN, and we have a regional conference or annual conference as well. So, it's really great that we can connect and learn from each other. I think that's probably the group I get the most from, because we have a listserv in different ways, so it's easy to just reach out and say, hey, I see you have X, Y, and Z. Can you share how you got that with me?
Yeah.
So you don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's so great to lean on people who have been there, done that, who have the experience, know what works, best practices.
Well, and I guess fairly, Florida is sort of a leader in resilience in terms of our ability to anticipate hurricanes and preposition resources to recover.
Yeah, absolutely, because that's something we've been experiencing.
Right, for
a long time.
Practice. Yeah.
Yes, lots of practice. Yeah. Practice makes perfect, kind of.
Yeah. Do you get involved in undergrounding utilities, like electricity and stuff?
That's not necessarily in my wheelhouse because we don't have a MOU, a municipally owned utility.
Right.
It's more FPL.
We had a chance for a few years back, but yeah. Okay. Well, that's something that really affects people is when the electricity goes out.
Mm-hmm.
We have one of those, they call it a generator, but it's really just a fancy battery that can power your refrigerator or whatever for a few days.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So that's been helpful.
Yeah, definitely going without power is a big challenge, and that's why, that redundancy, again, is super important with if you can get solar battery backup or just any different type of energy source or separate from a generator.
Something we're learning from the experience in Texas with the flooding is the need for redundancy in communication. Mm-hmm. You can't count on a single way to let people know what's happening.
Anything else you'd like to talk about, Aaliyah?
I'm looking at my list here. Just a couple more things I definitely wanted to mention. So I know I talked about the Green Living Toolkit, which is one of my favorite resources that we have here locally. I mentioned that there's the information on there about what people can do, and it's very action-oriented. But another thing I love about it is that it's very unique because it's the first of its kind community-wide calendar. So for people who, want to learn, it's a great resource, but there's also ways to get involved. So there's a calendar of all the upcoming community cleanups, events, classes. Any way that you want to get involved, you can search by like volunteering or event. So definitely check out that's at greenlivingtoolkit.org. And then speaking of classes, we at the city, I'm happy to do presentations for classes, community groups. So anytime that I can get out there and educate people, I'm super happy to be involved. But the UF IFAS Extension Office also has amazing classes on so many different types of topics. There's a Sea Grant agent, there's sustainability who has, energy efficiency and climate classes. There's water resources who will talk more about water quality. So definitely check out the UF IFAS Extension Eventbrite. And then speaking of water quality too, Gulf Coast Community Foundation has an amazing resource called the Water Quality Playbook. So it's waterqualityplaybook.org. Definitely check that out. It just has ways that we can reduce, individuals can reduce nutrients from getting into the bay and changing our water quality.
Okay, you have to leave, Aaliyah.
Yeah,
I know, I'm leaving. I don't want to. <No. laughs>
It's great to have you back and reconnect in your new habitat, your new context. So that's exciting.
Hopefully I'll be back soon with some great updates once I get more settled in, but appreciate you having me and looking forward to all we can do to make our city stronger for sure.
Yeah. Great. More sustainable and more resilient.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And the Sarasota County Fire Department will host a community open house on Saturday, July 19th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Station 21, 721 Center Road in Venice. Attendees can meet their local firefighters, receive car seat safety inspections, bike helmet fittings, and fire and swimming safety information. This event is open to the public. More information is available by visiting scgov.net or by calling 941-861-5000. That's 941-861-5000.
So if you're just tuning in hoping to hear Aaliyah Garrett talk about resilience and sustainability, you just missed her. You're going to have to listen to the archives. And we're really switching gears now to talk about something completely different. And that's because today is the anniversary of an important event in Florida and the nation's environmental history.
This is a reading from The Swamp, written by Michael Grunewald, which is a history of the Everglades, Florida, and the politics of paradise. This section is called A Martyr to the Cause. The state had no sheriffs canoeing the Everglades heat, so the National Audubon Society hired its own bird warden to enforce the pluming ban, a 32-year-old ship captain from Flamingo named Guy Bradley, a reformed plumer who knew every nook of South Florida's rookeries. Kirk Monroe, who recruited him for the job, described him as a sturdy, fearless fellow filled with a righteous indignation against the wretches who are using every effort to kill off the few remaining birds of the section, of that section. Bradley had tagged along on his first plume hunt at age 7. As a teenager, he had been one of the shooters on Jean Chevalier's expedition in the Everglades. The guy in entries like Guy Killed 8, and as a young man working as a surveyor for Flagler's Railroad, he had done some plume hunting on the side. But he later renounced bird slaughter and eagerly accepted a $35 a month Audubon job. A short but rugged man with thinning hair and bushy mustache, Bradley wasted no time making his presence felt in the Everglades, patrolling nesting sites, issuing citations, even searching the boats of gator hunters to make sure they were only hunting gators. He also gave tours to visiting ornithologists who praised his conscientiousness but worried about his safety. Bradley was thrusting himself between armed men and their livelihoods in the middle of nowhere, bringing the law to a wild frontier that hadn't exactly been clamoring for it. The most overt threat was 60-year-old Walter Smith, an honorary Confederate sharpshooter who had been blinded in his left eye at the Battle of the Wilderness. He had once been on good terms with Bradley, but the relationship had soured over local politics. Then, in the winter of 1905, Bradley ensured Smith's lasting hatred by arresting him for plume hunting and arresting his teenage son, Tom, twice. "You ever arrest one of my boys again, I'll kill you," Smith warned. On the morning of July 8th, Bradley was home in Flamingo with his wife and two boys when he heard gunfire across Florida Bay. He peered across the glassy water and saw Smith's blue schooner anchored at Oyster Keys, two small mangrove islands where Bradley had once done some poaching with Smith's sons. He could see the Smiths were again terrorizing the local cormorants, so he rowed his dinghy across the bay and announced that he was arresting Tom again. Smith demanded to see a warrant. "I don't need one," Bradley replied, according to Smith's account. "I saw them shoot into the rookery, and I see the dead birds. Put your gun down, Smith." Smith claimed that Bradley cursed at him and wildly fired his nickel-plated pistol, burying a bullet in the schooner's mast. Smith then shot Bradley to death with his .38 caliber rifle. Smith was arraigned in Key West by the local prosecutor, W. Hunt Harris, the senator responsible for Florida's bird protection law. But Smith knew how justice worked on the frontier, and a week later, Harris showed up to court as Smith's attorney. A lawyer hired by Audubon to monitor the trial noted that Smith's self-defense claim was outlandish. For starters, Bradley's pistol still had all six bullets in its chamber, but the stand-in prosecutor never challenged Smith's testimony and never checked his mast for the proposed bullet from the unfired gun. Smith was soon a free man, and the carnage resumed in the Everglades. There is no community sufficiently law-abiding to leave a bank vault unmolested if it were left unprotected, Frank Chapman sighed. We have given up. We can't protect it, and the rookery will have to go.
So a couple of things there. If any of you have ever been to Flamingo at the end of the road, it had been contemplated that that might be the jumping off point for the railroad that would go to Key West, and that idea was abandoned. But as I said, if you have been there and you're at the campground and you look basically to the south, I think that's Murray Key, and then off to the west of Murray Key are the Oyster Keys that he rode out to. So it was not unreasonable that Bradley could row out there. The other thing I want to mention is that it is not uncommon for people that had been hunters to, at some point in their life, decide they didn't want to hunt anymore. and I know two or three people in my personal experience that that's happened to, that they started out as hunters and ended up as just basically wildlife appreciators. So I'm going to set the context a little, and then Julie can tell us a little bit more about Guy Bradley. But as you probably have learned, when people got to the New World and it hadn't been plundered or harvested, or resources hadn't been taken, whether they were living or non-living, it was viewed as sort of God's providence that all this was here for the taking. And then in the U.S., with the acquisition of the Louisiana Purchase at the beginning of 1803, all this new land opened up. But eventually it started dawning on people that they were losing resources. And it was actually Abraham Lincoln that first made a move to start protecting Yosemite. And in 1883... there was an outfit called the American Ornithologists Union, and the founding of this AOU led both to the Audubon Society and also the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And once this group got rolling in 1886, they were reporting that by their estimate, the previous year, 1885, 5 million birds had been killed in what was called the millinery trade. Now, I grew up never knowing what millinery meant. My grandmother was a milliner. She had won a contest during the Depression. And milliners are people that make hats. I don't know why they don't call them hat makers, but it turns out they're called milliners because Milan, Italy, had been like an epicenter of hat making. And so they ended up being called milliners. At any rate, there was a guy named George Bird Grinnell. And this guy was a student of Audubon's widow. So he knew Audubon's widow, and he knew Audubon's grandchildren. So if you're wondering why a group that protects birds was named for Audubon, it was because of Grinnell's association. And he founded the Audubon Society, and he was the editor of a magazine publication called Forest and Stream. And one of his big contributions was that he had learned from Europe, even though a lot of animals had been extirpated in Europe, the practice of having game reserves for the king or the monarchy had demonstrated that you could have sustainable harvests in areas that were protected. And so this guy, Grinnell, was an advocate for having game wardens that would protect wildlife, for regulating how many animals you could kill on a day, a bag limit, and that he thought there should be fees, sort of hunting licenses, and that the fees from those would go towards conservation efforts. So just after all of this is happening, a guy named Cuthbert discovers a really large bird rookery in the Everglades. And then another guy who was mentioned in what Julie was reading, Frank Chapman, he was a New Jersey guy, and he worked in the American Museum of Natural History. And he was a member of this American Ornithologists Union. And every year there had been a tradition around Christmas to go out and shoot as many birds as you could. And so Chapman said, I've got an idea. Instead of shooting all these birds, maybe we could just count them. What would you think of that? So that was the origin of the Christmas bird count. It switched from a shoot as many birds as you can to just listing them. And so things are really starting to pick up. In 1900, the Lacey Act was passed, and that prohibited the interstate shipment of game taken in violation of state law. So one of the big problems in regulating the take of wildlife is that if you have different rules in one county than another county, or different rules in one state for another state, then people driving around with deer or ducks or whatever say, oh, I shot that over in the other joint. You know, I didn't take that here. So it was really, it became really important to have rules that regulated where game was taken, and trying to have consistent rules across boundaries wherever possible. So also in 1900, the Florida Audubon Society was formed in Maitland, Florida. So when people wonder, well, why is Audubon in Maitland? That's like a weird place. And it's because that's where it started. So it makes perfect sense. And then, and this is something I didn't know, in 1901, the Florida legislature passed a law that would protect non-game birds. So people had one way or the other divided birds into game birds and non-game birds. And Julie knows all about that and can tell you about it. But this newly formed Florida Audubon Society had lobbied to protect, to form this, get the legislature to protect the first law that protect the wading birds, the egrets and herons. And it prohibited the sale of their plumage. And if you were caught, it was $5 per bird, and you could be imprisoned for up to 10 days. The problem was, and this is continues to be a problem with Florida legislation, that the law did not provide any resources for enforcement. So it was up to private individuals to try and fund these wardens or protection. So I think we mentioned Chapman earlier. Yeah, Chapman worked at the American Museum of Natural History, and he and some other guy met with Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, and told him that poachers were decimating birds on a place called Pelican Island. And that led Roosevelt in 1903 to start the first federal bird reservation, which is Pelican Island, and that's over on the East Coast. And these, of course, are the forerunners of the National Wildlife Refuge System. But they also named a whole bunch of other, over the next few years, Roosevelt named a number of other locations for these to protect rookeries. And what's interesting, you know, there was Indian Key, which is in the Keys. There was Key West. There was Mosquito Inlet and the Tortugas. Those were all named by Roosevelt. But here's what I find interesting. He also established bird reservations at Matlache Pass, Passage Key, Pine Island, Palmasola Bay, which is there in Manatee County, and a place called Island Bay. Now, if you ask people where Island Bay is, I don't think many people could tell you. But Island Bay consists of some small keys just associated with the Cape Hayes Peninsula in Charlotte Harbor. So by 1940, the rookery that Cuthbert had discovered, I mean 1904, the rookery that Cuthbert had discovered had been shot out. And I think I'll cut to Julie at this point.
So this is from a book called Death in the Everglades, The Murder of Guy Bradley, America's First Martyr to Environmentalism. And it's by Stuart B. McIver. And the Myakka River comes up. At the mouth of the Myakka River, which flowed into Charlotte Harbor, he found only a deserted rookery. Farther upstream, he encountered bettered luck, finding a small mangrove island inhabited by several species of herons and egrets. These are the prices that you were able to earn from different kinds of wading birds. American egret, 40 cents. The snowy egret, 55 cents. Reddish egret, 40 cents. Louisiana heron, 10 to 15 cents. Ward's heron, 75 cents to $1. And roseate spoonbill, $2 to $5. A flat skin is the bird skin split underneath from the bill to the vent and skin so that the whole is perfectly flat when dry. Generally, the legs are cut off and sometimes the wings and even the head.
So if you got paid 40 cents for something in 1900, that's like over $15 today. So if you had a single feather that was worth 40 cents, that would be $15. So you could see a single bird, which might have dozens of plumes, would be very valuable.
These are notes by an explorer named Scott, who was sympathetic to protecting the birds, and he was interviewing plumers sometime in the late 1800s. What do you hunt? Asked Scott. Almost anything that wears feathers, Johnson said. His primary targets were the snowy heron, American egret, and reddish egret. These, he said, brought the highest prices when sold to taxidermists, as the plume buyers preferred to be called. I wish there was some law to protect the birds, said Johnson, at least during the breeding time, which wouldn't be broken. But since everybody else is pluming, I made up my mind I might just as well have my share. And who was the taxidermist Johnson sold his plumes to? Mr. J.H. Batty of New York City. And what was he buying? Almost anything that wears feathers, but more particularly the herons, spoonbills, and snowy birds.
Right. So the milliners, the hat makers, it was very popular to have portions or sometimes even entire dead birds on your hat. And so there, and we see this today. I mean, you still see people with feather boas, and feathers are still used in costuming and dresses and stuff. Probably not as much in hats anymore.
It seems like one of the Audubon initiatives was to switch from herons and egrets and roseate spoonbills on hats to ostrich feathers.
Right, which could be harvested. And then there's that whole story we've heard on the radio several times about the birds of paradise being plundered for unique feathers.
Again, back to Death in the Everglades, the murder of Guy Bradley. While waiting for his mail at Punta Rossa, Scott ran into Wilkerson again. His trip to Myakka Lake had not been fruitful. Persistent hunting had made the birds so shy that he had obtained only 75 plumes on a lengthy hunt. Scott hired Wilkerson to make the trip back to Tarpon Springs with him. Not less than 60 men were working on the Gulf Coast for batty in this way. From time to time, as we were together, I picked up these facts, and I have been careful to understate rather than overestimate the destruction that was going on from this single source. And so 60 men were working for this Mr. Batty, a taxidermist in New York City, to shoot up bird rookeries on the Florida Gulf Coast.
Right, and taxidermist was sort of a euphemism.
Right, for hat makers.
Right, and so, I mean, Julian, what's going on, if you're new to the area, is that these wading birds are colonial nesting birds. And so instead of each having, like a robin, will have a nest in one location, and or let's use the mockingbird, which is more Florida, there'll be another mockingbird so many feet away, but they're not all clustered together. The colonial wading birds, they all nest on typically mangrove islands, like can be in other locations. And when they have young, they have to return to feed their young. So these rookeries were the easiest place to kill hundreds of birds that would have been difficult to kill individually elsewhere. And so it's these rookeries that were being targeted and that Roosevelt was trying to protect.
And, you know, during their nesting season, killing the adult birds leaves the birds of the year who are hatching out in their nests to predation by crows.
They starve to death.
They starve to death,
yeah,
right.
So not very sustainable.
Right, that's right. That's right. This is again from the Death in the Everglades, The Murder of Guy Bradley. It's scarcely necessary. This is Scott when he gets back to Princeton. He concluded, it is scarcely necessary to draw any conclusions or inferences. This great and growing evil speaks for itself. I have the name and addresses of some 50 dealers in various towns in Florida and the principal cities of the country. Merchants in New York and other centers are buying every month the skins and plumes of Florida birds. The price paid for such material, notwithstanding the efforts made to create sympathy for the birds and a feeling against using the feathers for hats and other decorative purposes, is each year becoming higher, showing how great is the demand and how profitable the traffic to these milliners. And then again from The Death in the Everglades, The Murder of Guy Bradley, the Fort Myers Press, which is the Fort Myers newspaper, continuing today, realized considerable revenue from the plume industry ads. Some were placed by firms in the Northeast, such as Otto Wagner and Lewisham and Company of New York, W. Goldsby of Boston, and R. Washington and Company of Baltimore. Substantial local merchants who represented the New York millinery industry also advertised regularly. A particularly large advertiser was the prominent firm of Bain and Evans, dealers in Florida curiosities, plumes, white egret and pelican skins, alligator teeth, and all native birds of taxidermist. J.W. Bain was the local postmaster. Do you want to get back to your chronology, John?
Well, I'm just so the rookery was shot out in 1904, and Bradley was shot in 1905. Is that right?
Yeah. So again, this is Death in the Everglades, The Murder of Guy Bradley. Thus, Guy Bradley, who had killed his share of plume birds, began to have second thoughts about his destructive pursuit. When he and Lou and Charlie Pierce were kids, it had been fun to test their marksmanship as the birds flew in and out of the rookeries, chattering and squawking cheerfully along the way. But now the fun was giving way to doubts, and not just for Guy Bradley.
So, Julie, am I remembering correctly that when we were camped on Devilfish Key, we heard people shooting in the rookery?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is, you know, The rookeries are always in danger, either from people approaching too close and spooking the birds, or people that actually just like shooting things.
Again, from Death in the Everglades, the murder of Guy Bradley. One of the toughest obstacles facing the new chairman was Florida. The largest concentration of plume birds lay in the vast Everglades, but Florida was a state without a law to protect them. In May of 1901, Dutcher traveled to Tallahassee while the Florida state legislature was in session. He had never before ventured into La Florida, the land of flowers. It was a primitive state, still in its pioneer stages, according to the United States Census Florida guidelines. It ranked in 1900 as the country's third least populated state, with just over 500,000 residents.
So you've already read to us about Bradley being shot, right?
Yeah.
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 Is there something else you want to get in?
On May 29th, 1902, Dutcher sent Guy Bradley a letter of certification that stated, "Mr. Guy Bradley of Flamingo, Florida, is now employed by the AOU as a warden for the purpose of enforcing the bird law of the state of Florida, Chapter 4957, approved May 29th, 1901. The duties of the said Guy M. Bradley are to strictly enforce the said Florida bird law to the effect that he shall prevent the killing of all protected birds or taking their eggs."
So Guy Bradley is the first person we know of hired to protect wildlife that was killed in the United States. And I just read this morning about an 87-year-old guy who stopped on the interstate to help a turtle across the road, and he was hit and killed. And people are writing in saying, well, what happened to the turtle? And other people are saying, why do you care about the turtle? And people are saying, because this guy died trying to help a turtle. That's why we're concerned about the turtle. Was there something else you wanted to get in?
Yeah, in the year 1903, Guy's first full year as a warden had been a busy one. That year, the price offered to hunters for egret plumes rose to $32 an ounce, more than twice the price for an ounce of gold. Four egrets had to die to yield an ounce of plumes. Bradley's vigilance had helped create a scarcity that was driving the price up and ultimately making the rookeries all more tempting to plume hunters.
Yikes. Okay, so we're running out of time. Let's fast forward a little. So Bradley is killed in Florida in 1905.
Yeah.
You read about that. Then in 1908, a guy named Columbus McLeod, he was a Florida Audubon game warden, and he was in Charlotte Harbor, and he was killed. And then also in 1908, a guy named L.P. Reeves was killed in Florida, and he was trying to stop fish poaching, not bird poaching. In 1909, they discovered, or maybe they already knew, but in 1909, people descended on an island in the Hawaiian archipelago. And this island was only 2 miles long and a half mile wide. And it was estimated they killed 300,000 birds on Lysan Island. And so that got described in a book in 1913. In 1911, New York passed an Audubon plumage bill. In 1914, the last passenger pigeon, Martha, died in a zoo in St. Louis. And then in 1918, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act stopped commercial hunting of birds. Now we need to get one more. The Suncoast Center for Independent Living is hosting an event on Friday, June 11th from 3 to 7 at 3281 17th Street, Florida. They invite the community to celebrate the Americans with Disabilities Act by gathering together for family-friendly activities, refreshments, and opportunities for connection. The event's open to the public. The Suncoast Center for Independent Living provides services to support persons with qualified disability living in Sarasota and Manatee counties to lead self-directed lives. It includes peer mentoring, skills training, advancement advocacy, additional knowledge and information sources, plus local and national referral resources. More information is at SCIL4U.org or by calling 941-351-9545.
You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio.